Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Nan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Isaiah chapter 29, which I will call the Siege of Jerusalem. Now, which siege was it? The commentators, of course, split like they often do on the discussion of various events in Isaiah. I'm going to assume it's the Siege of Jerusalem by the Babylonians in 586 BC. I'll give you my reasons as we go through. We start now in verses 1 through 4. Isaiah says this, "Woe to you, Ariel, Ariel, the city where David settled," that's Jerusalem, "add year to year and let your cycle of festivals go on. Yet I will besiege Ariel, she will mourn and lament, she will be to me like an altar hearth. I will encamp against you all around. I will encircle you with towers and set up my siege works against you. Brought low, you will speak from the ground. Your speech will mumble out of the dust. Your voice will come ghost-like from the earth. Out of the dust, your speech will whisper." Now, in verse 1, Isaiah calls Jerusalem Ariel. Ariel, Ariel. Well, what does the word Ariel mean? Semantically, it means the Lion of God, option number 1, or option number 2, the Hearth of God. Adam Clark prefers Lion of God. Albert Barnes says that is the less preferable option. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown and Barnes prefer the Hearth of God. Well, these two options have been around since ancient times. Nobody really knows. In favor of the idea that Jerusalem is the Hearth of God, not the Lion of God, we see that Ezekiel calls the altar of burnt offering Ariel in Ezekiel 43, verses 15 and 16. The altar hearth, Ariel. The altar hearth is 7 feet high, etc., etc. That's the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. The Targum translation of the whole line is, as provided by Gill, "Woe, altar, altar," instead of Ariel, Ariel, "woe, altar, altar, which was built in the city where David dwelt." Well, I report that. You decide it. I have no idea semantically what the word means. How about figuratively? Why is the word Ariel applied to Jerusalem? Well, the reason is, quote-unquote, obscure and doubtful, as both Adam Clark and Joseph Benson say. Well, let's look at the possibilities. First of all, if the word means hearth of God, if so, then it is used as a synecdoche for Jerusalem. A synecdoche is when you use a part of something to refer to the whole. And so the hearth of God is referring to the bronze altar, which is a part of Jerusalem, and the bronze altar, therefore, stands for Jerusalem. Now, fire lay upon the altar, and Joseph Benson says that fire devoured sacrifices like a lion devours prey. John Gill basically says the same thing. So the idea is that fire from the altar will consume God's enemies. Well, I have trouble taking it that far, because Jerusalem was about to get burned up, not vice versa. Jerusalem is not burning up God's enemies. But it could just refer to the hearth of God, the hearth of God, the altar of God, the altar of God. As a part for the whole, that's reasonable. But it's also reasonable to say that Ariel refers to the Lion of God, referring to the temple. John Gill says it's shaped like a lion. I have a hard time seeing how a temple is shaped like a lion. However, a lion is very strong, and Jerusalem was strong. It had natural and artificial fortifications. And so it would make sense to call Jerusalem a lion because of its strength. But if it means Lion of God, the best option for that reference is that a lion refers to the tribe of Judah. You know, Lion of Judah on the throne. Judah had a lion on its standard, as a matter of fact. Its founder, Judah, the patriarch, was referred to as a lion in Genesis 49:9. Jacob says, "You are a lion's cub, O Judah. You return from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches down and lies down, like a lioness." So Judah is long been associated in Jewish history with a lion. And then, of course, in Revelation 5:5, we read, "Then one of the elders said to me, 'Stop crying. Look, the Lion from the tribe of Judah.'" And, of course, that refers to Jesus. So the easiest way to take Ariel is to say it's referring to a lion. "Woe to you, Lion, Lion, Lion of Judah, the city where David settled." I don't know if that's right, but it could be. At the end of verse 1, Isaiah says, "Add year to year, and let your cycle of festivals go on." When he says add year to year, what he means is go on from year to year in your security and vain confidence. Just keep on. Just keep right on having your three festivals a year. But something bad's going to happen in the midst of those cycles of festivals. "Yet too, yet I will besiege Ariel. I will besiege Jerusalem, and she will mourn and lament. That's the beginning of verse 2. Now, the question is, when is this prophesied siege of Jerusalem going to occur? I'm going to give you three options, and I will choose one. Option number one, Sennacherib, with his Assyrian invasion, which culminated in 701 BC. This option is favored by the Cambridge commentator. Clark mentions it as a possible solution, although he also says it refers to the Roman destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Barnes says it's probably Sennacherib. Well, here's an argument that it can't be Sennacherib. This is from John Gill. He says this, quote, "This cannot be understood of Sennacherib's siege, for he was not suffered to raise a bank against the city, nor shoot an arrow into it." Gill quotes Isaiah 37:33 to show that there were no siege works raised up in the time of Sennacherib's siege, quote, "Therefore, this is what the Lord says concerning the king of Assyria. He will not enter this city or shoot an arrow here. He will not come before it with shield or build a siege ramp against it." He will not build a siege ramp against it. But now we read in verse 3 of our chapter here, Isaiah 29, verse 3, "I will encircle you with towers and set up my siege works against you." Now that seems to cut pretty strongly against Sennacherib. I think John Gill has a very good argument. I did not find in my other commentators any arguments against Gill or even any mention of that argument, but it impressed me, so I'm going to knock out Sennacherib 701 BC as an option as to when this siege is going to take place, mentioned by Isaiah in verse 2 of Isaiah 29. Option number 2, and this is the option I prefer. It doesn't seem to have anything against it. There were siege works raised up against Jerusalem by the Babylonians, and we see in verse 17, in just a little while, all these events are going to occur, and the Babylonian captivity, 586, is fairly close to Isaiah's time, which is 8th century. Babylonia is the 6th century, so a little over 100 years, and so I think there are a few objections to taking this as the Babylonian siege. Now, John Gill prefers the Roman siege of Jerusalem in AD 70, which it very well could be, except for the problem of in a little while. AD 70 is over 700 years past Isaiah's time. That doesn't sound like in a little while, but verse 17, Isaiah says, in just a little while, these events are going to happen. So I reject the AD 70 interpretation preferred by John Gill. Now, whether I'm right or not, I'll report it. You decide, as always. Now, in verse 2, Isaiah says that Jerusalem will be to me like an altar hearth. That's that same word, Ariel, except translated here in the NIV as altar hearth. Ariel, altar hearth, you're going to be to me as an altar hearth. What does that mean? Well, here's what Albert Barnes says. "As the altar of burnt offerings was surrounded daily by the victims which were offered, so the walls of Jerusalem shall be surrounded by the dead bodies of those who had rebelled against the Lord and who should be victims to his justice." In other words, Jerusalem's going to have a lot of sacrifices on its altar, but the sacrifices are going to be dead Israelites or dead Judahites. Or as John Gill puts it, Jerusalem has been, quote, "covered with the blood and carcasses of slain beasts, so this with the blood and carcasses of men." Now in verse 4, Isaiah says that you, people of Jerusalem, will be brought low. You will speak from the ground. Your speech will mumble out of the dust. What does he mean by that? Your voice will come ghost-like from the earth. Out of the dust your speech will whisper. Now I have four interesting options as to how that might be interpreted. First option, this weak voice from the dust refers to the submissive language of Hezekiah to Sennacherib, 701 B.C., Hezekiah had his back against the wall. He was in deep doo-doo. And so he says in 2 Kings 18:14. "So Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent word to the king of Assyria," that's Sennacherib, "at Lachish," that's the city to the southwest of Jerusalem that Sennacherib was besieging at the time, or Sennacherib's army was, saying, 'I have done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you demand from me, I will pay.'" Weak, thin voice from the dust where Hezekiah has got his head bowed down into. Well, that's option number one. Option number two, and of course that option depends, option number one depends upon the siege happening at the time of Sennacherib, which I have just dismissed because there were no siege works done with the time of Sennacherib, but verse 3 says there will be siege works thrown up. So let's go to option number two. this weak little voice coming out of the dust shows the humble state of Jerusalem after it was besieged. And I'm saying it was besieged by the Babylonians. John Gill says, quote, now he's referring it to the siege by the Romans, but this is what he says, expressive of the great famine in Jerusalem at the time of its siege by the Romans, when the inhabitants were so reduced by it as that they were scarce able to speak as to be heard, and could not stand upon their legs, but fell to the ground and lay in the dust, uttering from thence their speech with a faint and feeble voice. Well, I like Gill's description of the victims of the siege of Jerusalem in AD 70, but I can apply it also to the siege of Jerusalem by the Babylonians in 586. People were pretty weak then. Option number three, these voices from the dust could refer to the souls of the dead speaking. This was a popular notion among the heathens as well as among the Jews, that the souls of the dead uttered a feeble sound, which was very different from the natural human voice. So all the dead people are crying up from the dust, ooh, we got killed by the Babylonians. Option number four. This is referring to necromancers, people who speak with the dead, supposedly. But these were not people who were really speaking from the dead, but were ventriloquists who threw their voice down to the dust so that it sounded like a voice from the dead was coming up from the dust. This is what Adam Clark says. They, quote, had an art of speaking with a feigned voice so as to deceive those who applied to them by making them believe that it was the voice of the ghost. They had a way of uttering sounds as if they were formed not by the organs of speech but deep in the chest or in the belly, and were thence called ventriloquy. They could make the voice seem to come from beneath the ground, from a distant part in another direction, and not from themselves. Now, if this is a true option, it would be appropriate because Jerusalem had sought necromancers, and now they were made to be like necromancers, consulting the spirits of the dead. Isaiah 8:19, when they say to you, consult the spirits of the dead, and the spirit is to chirp and mutter, shouldn't a people consult their God? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? Well, of all those options, I believe the best option is option number two. Isaiah is just trying to show the humble state of the people of Judah after Jerusalem was besieged. They were so humble, their faces were in the dust, so whenever they spoke, their voice came from the dust. We go now to Isaiah 29, verses 5 through 8. Isaiah continues, but your many enemies will become like fine dust, the ruthless hordes like blown chaff. Suddenly, in an instant, the Lord Almighty will come with thunder and earthquake and great noise, with windstorm and tempest and flames of a devouring fire. Then the hordes of all the nations that fight against Ariel, that attack her and her fortress and besiege her, will be as it is with a dream, with a vision in the night. As when a hungry man dreams that he is eating, but he awakens and his hunger remains, as with the hordes of all the nations that fight against Mount Zion. In verse 5, Isaiah says, your many enemies will become like fine dust. Why is enemies plural? I suspect it's because the armies of all the enemies of Israel had many constituent nations. That's true of the three main enemies of Israel, Assyria, Babylonia, Rome, especially Rome, it's well known. All kinds of different nations made up the armies of Rome and the other two kingdoms. Now in verse 5 we have a problem, but your many enemies will become like fine dust, the ruthless hordes like blown chaff. Suddenly in an instant, verse 6, the Lord Almighty will come with thunder and earthquake and great noise. Now, what is this referring to? The enemies becoming like fine dust and the ruthless hordes like blown chaff. Well, Ellicott and Barnes say it's Sennacherib's army being destroyed in 701 B.C. I have a problem with that. I've already mentioned the problem. There were no siege works raised up against Jerusalem by Sennacherib because Isaiah said there were no siege works in Isaiah 33. That's one problem. Well, here's another problem. Sennacherib's armies will become like fine dust. In verse 16, the Lord Almighty will come against Sennacherib with thunder, earthquake, great noise, windstorm, tempest, flames of a devouring fire. That didn't happen. There was a plague of something. The angel of the Lord struck all the soldiers, and they took off silently in the middle of the night. All this stuff didn't happen in verse 6. Now, of course, you could always take that figuratively, but that sounds pretty precise. And it doesn't sound like what happened to Sennacherib. So what's another way we can take this? Well, we can say, but your many enemies are like fine dust. Not will become like, as the NIV has it, but they are like fine dust. The Roman Christian Study Bible says your many foes will be like fine dust. In other words, there's so many of them coming that it's just like the uncountable number of grains of dust in the sand, or the uncountable pieces of chaff that are blown in the wind. In other words, the idea here is not that the enemies of Jerusalem are going to go down, but Jerusalem is going to go down because of the so many enemies coming upon it. Now, I have found some commentators to back me up on that. Joseph Benson says, quote, "Some, however, think that these verses should be connected with the preceding and that the prophet continues in them to describe the judgment to be inflicted on Jerusalem." And I hold with that opinion. Apparently, it's a minority opinion. John Gill says, quote, "Small dust is not used to express the weakness of the enemies, but the greatness of their number, which was not to be counted any more than the dust of the earth." So in other words, the dust metaphor refers not to the weakness of Israel's enemies, of Judah's enemies, but it refers to the number of Judah's enemies. Pulpit commentator quotes a Dr. K and says this, quote, "Dr. K says it is the collapse of Jerusalem which is here intended." Now, pulpit says, no, they disagree with Dr. K. They say it's rather the collapse of the enemies and not the collapse of Jerusalem. So we have reasonable, learned opinion on both sides of the issue. One thing favoring the idea that it's the destruction of Israel's enemies is because when we get down into verse 7 and 8, it's obviously the destruction of Israel's enemies. And so we say, okay, well, the context would say this is the destruction of Israel's enemies. However, the immediate context, verse 6, says the Lord's going to come with thunder, earthquake, great noise, windstorm, tempest, and flames. That doesn't sound like Sennacherib's defeat to me. Now, John Gill backs me up. He thinks it's the Roman army, not the Babylonian army. But besides that little detail, he says that verse 6 does not sound like the plague that ran Sennacherib's army off. The thunder, the earthquake, the great noise, the windstorm, the tempest, and the flames. But it's amazing how many commentators will say, oh yes, it's Sennacherib. I have trouble with that. So did John Gill. And so in verse 6, the flames of a devouring fire could refer to the fire that burned up Jerusalem, I think in 586 B.C., because of the Babylonian siege. Or it could be that, if you hold to the other option, it's the enemies of Israel that are going to get wiped out. Then it refers to the armies of the enemies getting eaten up with a devouring fire. Verse 7, "Then the hordes of all the nations that fight against Ariel, against Jerusalem, that attack her and her fortress, and besiege her. I guess you could say that Sennacherib besieged Jerusalem. He gathered around the city, his army. So that does not disprove Sennacherib right there. However, in verse 3, Isaiah says, "I will set up my siege works against you." Sennacherib didn't do that. Well, assuming that the besieging armies were the Babylonians, as I have assumed, perhaps wrongly, they're going to get wiped out. Well, they did. They got wiped out by the Persians in 539 B.C. Now, in verse 7, Isaiah says, "The hordes of all the nations." Again, horde sounds like the amount of people coming in, enemies coming into Jerusalem. "The hordes of all these nations that fight against Jerusalem will be as it is with a dream, with a vision in the night." Well, how can an army coming in be likened unto a dream? "As when a hungry man dreams that he is eating," in verse 8, "but he awakens and his hunger remains." This is how, let's say I'm dreaming about eating a delicious hamburger. I am starving to death, and the hamburger is thick. It's got melted cheese on top, tomatoes, lettuce, mayonnaise, ketchup, mustard, spices, Chinese five spice, garlic, onions. And I am dreaming about this hamburger, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, this hamburger is going to taste so good. But then I wake up, and there's no hamburger, and I'm starving to death. Well, so it will be with the Babylonians. They think that they've got Jerusalem conquered forever after they burn it down. But then they're going to wake up when they realize the Persians have conquered them, and they're not going to have Jerusalem anymore. They're going to be like a hungry man waking up and still being hungry, or a thirsty man dreaming that he's drinking, waking up, and he's still thirsty. So will it be with the hordes of all the nations that fight against Mount Zion. Israel lived on after the Babylonian siege. They lived on after the Roman siege, even in AD 70 in the New Jerusalem, the church. So Isaiah mixes in a little bit of good news with the bad news, as he often does. After judgment, there's restoration. In fact, the purpose of judgment is that God's will be established. It's not because God's up there wanting to be nasty to people. He wants to judge sin, correct it, and establish righteousness. We go down to Isaiah 29, verses 9 through 10. Isaiah continues, "Be stunned and amazed, blind yourselves and be sightless, be drunk but not from wine, stagger, but not from beer, the Lord has brought over you a deep sleep. He has sealed your eyes, the prophets. He has covered your heads, the seers. I'm going to just say prophet and seers are the same thing. I know that theologians love to talk about the distinction, but we're not going to worry about that. Why are these leaders of Jerusalem drunk and staggering? Because they're stupid, senseless, and they're secure, even though they are in utmost danger. They're blind to it. They stagger around because they are unsteady in their counsels and resolutions and their principles and practices. They stumble in their goings. And in verse 10, the Lord explains why. The Lord has brought over you a deep sleep. Now, of course, this is a judicial blindness and hardness of heart. The Lord did it, but it was in response to their sin. And so God judges them. In verse 10, he's made them blind, put them in a deep sleep. He has sealed your eyes. The prophets covered your heads. The seers, if you cover your head, you can't see. And if you seal your eyes, of course, you can't see either. So the point is the prophets who were prophesying, no problem with the Babylonians coming in, no problem. There are a lot of them, as we'll see when we get to the book of Jeremiah, but they're prophesying stupidity, nonsense. Now, these seers who had their heads covered, what does covered refer to? A couple of options here. Option number one, this may be an allusion to the covering of the head with a veil, an emblem of that veil of ignorance and infidelity which still remains upon the Jews, as I think it was John Gill who said that. One of my commentators says that. Another option is that this verse 10 refers to the Orientals covering the head to sleep. So covered is parallel to closing your eyes. They're sleeping with a veil over their eyes so they can't see anything. It could be option number three, they had their eyes covered because back then it was customary to cover the face of someone who was about to be executed capitally. Well, those are nice speculations. I just think that what it means is they can't see. They're prophesying nonsense because they can't see the will of God. They don't understand God. We go down to verses 11 through 12. Isaiah continues, "For you, this whole vision is nothing but words sealed in a scroll. And if you give the scroll to someone who can read and say to him, 'Read this, please,' he will answer, 'I can't. It is sealed.' Or if you give the scroll to someone who cannot read and say, 'Read this, please,' he will answer, 'I don't know how to read.'" Those are just excuses, these blind, staggering fools that are now ruling Jerusalem. Isaiah says to them, "This whole vision is nothing." In other words, you people are too stupid to understand it, so it's nothing to you. If I give this scroll of my prophecy to someone and say, "Read it," and you say, "I can't, it's sealed," that's just a stupid excuse. All you got to do is break the seal and read it. So in other words, there will always be false prophets giving soothing words of encouragement to people who are doomed to extinction. We go now to Isaiah 29, verses 13 through 16. Isaiah continues, "The Lord says, 'These people come near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me.'" Sounds like these left-wing progressive churches talking about how they love homosexuals. They don't love homosexuals. They love lies is what they love. Their hearts are far from God, but they've got the churches. They've got the ecclesiastical garments. They've got the fancy titles after their names. They got bucket loads of money in their bank accounts. Their worship, again, referring back to the people of Judah, not the modern day apostate denominations of which we are all so familiar. There, the Judahites' worship of me is made up only of rules taught by men. Ooh, that sounds like legalist. "Therefore, once more, I will astound these people with wonder upon wonder. The wisdom of the wise will perish. The intelligence of the intelligent will vanish. Woe to those who go to great depths to hide their plans from the Lord, who do their work in darkness and think, 'Who sees us? Who will know?' You turn things upside down, as if the potter were thought to be like the clay. Shall what is formed say to him who formed it, 'He did not make me'? Can the pot say of the potter, 'He knows nothing?'" In verse 13, Isaiah quotes the Lord as saying, "These people come near me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far away from me. Their worship is only rules." Well, Jesus quoted that in Matthew 15, 7 through 8. "Hypocrites," Jesus said, "Isaiah prophesied correctly about you when he said, 'These people honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me.'" So Jesus used Isaiah to attack the Pharisees of his age. There will always be Pharisees as long as they are human beings and as long as there is religion. Verse 14, Isaiah says, quoting God, he says, Therefore, once more, I will astound these people with wonder upon wonder. What is the wonder? As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, it is the unparalleled vengeance on the hypocrites, as the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 586 really was unparalleled. It was an amazing siege and destruction, which everybody, every Christian should read Josephus and read about the siege of Jerusalem. That's the AD 70 one. And we can imagine that AD 586 one was just as bad. Well, we can read in the book of Lamentations, for example, some of the bad things that happened there. But it would be a wondrous thing as it happened all of a sudden. The wisdom of the wise will perish. In other words, all these wise scribes walking around using their so-called wisdom to teach the people of Judah, they're going to be gone because they're going to get burnt up in the destruction of the city. The intelligence of the intelligence will vanish. Same thing, no more teachers, no more scribes. Here's what John Gill says about the perishing of wisdom in the city. From the time the temple was destroyed, he was referring to AD 70, but it works with 586 BC also. From the time the temple was destroyed, the wise men became like the scribes, and the scribes are those who looked after the synagogues, the janitors, in other words, and those became like the common people, and then the janitors came like people who didn't have anything to do with the synagogue, and they grew worse and worse. And Maimonides, the great Jewish philosopher, 11th century AD, I think he was, acknowledges that this respects their present case. He says, when the heathen princes destroyed their best things, they took away their wisdom and their books and killed their wise men, and they became ignorant and unlearned, which evil God threatened them for their iniquities, as is said in this passage. And John Gill says that this prophecy was literally fulfilled in AD 70, because in the Middle Ages, poor old Maimonides, the great Jewish intellectual, didn't have anything to work with too much because it had all gotten burnt up. Well, that's interesting, but again, I don't think it's AD 70. I think it's B.C. 586. In verse 15, Isaiah continues, woe to those who go to great depths to hide their plans from the Lord, who do their work in darkness and think, who sees us? Who will know? So Isaiah is talking about just people who are corrupt, evil, leading the country. Verse 16, you turn things upside down as if the potter were thought to be like the clay. No, the potter is over the clay. The clay is not over the potter. This verse, of course, is quoted in Romans chapter 9, verse 20, Paul says to the Romans, but who are you, O mere man, to talk back to God? Will what is formed say to the one who formed it, why did you make me like this? Paul is talking about how can you say it's unjust for God to choose some, predestine some to hell, and predestine others to hell. And Paul says, wait a minute, God can do what he wants. You just shut up. He's the potter, you're the clay. Isaiah is saying the same thing. Shall what is formed, the pot, say to him who formed it, the potter, he did not make me. Can the pot say of the potter he knows nothing? Well, of course not. We go now to Isaiah 29, verse 17 through 21. Verse 17 has that phrase in a short time, which makes me think this is not referring to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. In a very short time, Isaiah continues, will not Lebanon be turned into a fertile field, and the fertile field seem like a forest? In that day the deaf will hear the words of the scroll, and out of gloom and darkness the eyes of the blind will see. Once more the humble will rejoice in the Lord. The needy will rejoice in the Holy One of Israel. The ruthless will vanish. The mockers will disappear. And all who have an eye for evil will be cut down. Those who with a word make a man out to be guilty, who ensnare the defender in court, and with false testimony deprive the innocent of justice. Now Isaiah here is just going on a rant against evil, corruption. In verse 17 he says, in a very short time, here's some options. First, by Gary Smith, he says that the military situation with Assyria will be turned around soon. And of course all those other commentators who say that Isaiah is referring to the invasion of Sennacherib would agree with this. And that's true, that happened in a very short time, but where the siege works. Verse 3 says they're going to be siege works. Sennacherib, he came in a very short time, but he didn't put up any siege works, and so that's why I throw Sennacherib out, according to the logic given to me by John Gill. And interestingly, this Gary Smith, as soon as he says this is Assyria, he says, but the very next verses are probably eschatological. Verse 18, the deaf will hear, gloom and darkness in the midst of that. The blind will see. I don't know whether Smith means eschatological as referring to the first coming of Jesus or the second coming of Jesus. But either way, that's not in a very short time. So I'm going to take this as referring to the exiles returning from Babylon. Barnes says perhaps that's true. I couldn't find anybody else to really agree with me except Barnes, perhaps. But that's the way I'm going to take it. In a very short time, i.e. at the time that the Babylonians come in 586 B.C., will not Lebanon be turned into a fertile field and the fertile field seem like a forest? Now, that phrase is proverbial, and it means things change quickly, kind of like the woke nightmare that's afflicting America as woke progressives defecate rhetorically and philosophically all over the United States of America and Western Europe. That happened all of a sudden, and that's what this metaphor means. Lebanon, which is a forest of cedars, they're famous for that, will be turned into a fertile field. It takes a long time to get cedar trees out of the ground and make a farm field out of it, but the proverb here means it's going to happen quickly. Something big, something that normally takes a long time, will happen. A forest will be changed into a field quickly, and the fertile field will seem like a forest. It grows up quickly. Normally it takes a long time for a forest to grow out of a fertile field, but here it's going to happen quickly. All right, having established what the proverb means, what's going to happen very quickly in a very short time? Well, Gary Smith says that in a very short time, the military situation will change quickly with Assyria as Sennacherib runs back to Assyria in 701 B.C. However, I've got four commentators, Gill, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, Benson, and Poole, who say that this proverb refers to Gentiles being converted in the time of Christ. That's when Lebanon will be turned into a fertile field and vice versa. As John Gill says, quote, "The Gentile world, which was like a forest uncultivated and full of unfruitful trees to which wicked men may be compared, should through the preaching of the gospel be manured, become God's husbandry, and like a fruitful field, abounding with people and churches, fruitful in grace and good works." Adam Clark says that this was a proverbial saying expressing any great revolution of things, and when respecting two subjects, an entire reciprocal change. Explained here by some interpreters, I think with great probability, as having its principal view beyond the revolutions then near at hand, to the rejection of the Jews and the calling of the Gentiles. Now, in favor of this belief that this revolution that's going to happen in a short time is going to occur in the days of the Messiah at the preaching of the gospel to the Gentiles, verse 18, the very next verse says, "In that day the deaf will hear and the eyes will see." Well, that's what Jesus did. But again, there's a very big problem with taking this cedars of Lebanon to fertile field sudden revolution to refer to Gentiles suddenly converting to Christ. It's going to happen in a very short time. Verse 17, Isaiah was prophesying in the mid to late 8th century, 700s B.C. That's 700 years before the Gentiles started getting converted to Christ. It doesn't sound like a very short time to me. So let's go back to my solution that Isaiah in this chapter is referring to the destruction of Jerusalem in 586, then the destruction of the Babylonians in 539 by the Persians, and then the return of the exiles to Jerusalem in 538 or 537. What do I do with verse 18? "In that day the deaf will hear the words of the scroll, and out of gloom and darkness the eyes of the blind will see." Well, I take it to mean that Isaiah is saying that people will now understand. Their eyes will see, their ears will hear. They'll understand the words of his prophecy. They'll see it, they'll understand it, and they'll hear it, which means they will acknowledge it as being true. Now, to show that I'm not speaking out of my hat on this, I got four commentators who back me up on that. They say that verse 18 is figurative. It's not referring to actual healing of the eyes, healing of blind eyes, and the healing of deaf ears. It's referring to the fact that Isaiah is saying the people will, at that future time, they will understand the purpose of God's judgment. Barnes, Cambridge, Poole, and Pulpit all agree with me on that, so I think that's reasonable. So I think we're still talking about Babylon. Verse 19, "Once more the humble will rejoice in the Lord." That's after they return to Jerusalem. "The needy will rejoice in the Holy One of Israel." And God, yes, the poor people will rejoice in God because they are no longer in Babylon. They're back in Jerusalem. "The ruthless will vanish. The mockers will disappear, and all who have an eye for evil will be cut down." That's referring to the evil people who ruled Jerusalem before the destruction in 586. Verse 21, "Those who with a word make a man out to be guilty, who ensnare the defender in court, and with false testimony deprive the innocent of justice." Notice how verse 21 is talking about crimes done in the court system, and as an ex-lawyer, I'm very sensitive to that. I'm telling you, there is nothing worse than when justice is perverted. Nothing. Because Judges have nothing but total power once they make their decision, or when a jury makes a decision. That's it, buddy. I mean, you can go through appeals, but once the appeals are done, and sometimes it takes 10 years, 20 years before justice is done if a wrong judgment has been made or if somebody's been bribed. So Isaiah was very sensitive about that. We go now to Isaiah 29, verses 22 through 24, and we will finish this chapter. Therefore, this is what the Lord, Isaiah says, who redeemed Abraham, says to the house of Jacob. Quote, this is Yahweh speaking now. No longer will Jacob be ashamed, no longer will their faces grow pale. When they see among them their children, the work of my hands, they will keep my name holy. They will acknowledge the holiness of the Holy One of Jacob and will stand in awe of the God of Israel. Those who are wayward in spirit will gain understanding. Those who complain will accept instruction. Now, I'm going to take all that good news and redemption and holiness and awe of God is to refer to the fact that the Babylonians purged Israel of Israel's desire for idolatry. They gave up idolatry when they were in Babylon, exile, and they came back, and that was the end of the idolatry. Now, in verse 22, the Lord is said to have redeemed Abraham. Well, nowhere in the scriptures does it really ever say precisely that Abraham was redeemed. Here are some possible solutions to that problem. Abraham could be said to be redeemed when God called Abraham from Ur, the way Israel was called from Egypt. In other words, he was called out of slavery. Redemption means to buy out of slavery. God bought him out of slavery, set him free from the idolaters in Ur and later on in Haran. So redeemed would be metaphorical for cared for. The Lord cared for Abraham, got him out of slavery, got him out of paganism and idolatry. Now God says no longer will Jacob, Jacob's another word for Israel, the patriarch Jacob had two names, Jacob and Israel, and the nation of Israel had two names, Jacob and Israel. No longer will Jacob be ashamed. Now, when is that? No longer in the times of the Messiah, because in the times of the Messiah, you've got new Israel. The church will no longer be ashamed, but the church will be prosperous and will spread its message of salvation to the whole world. Or, and that, of course, is the opinion of John Gill, or it could be referring to the return of the exiles from Babylon. That's the view I take. Now, of course, that return from Babylon to Israel is a type of all the Gentile nations streaming into the new Zion, the church. I just don't think it was directly prophesied by Isaiah, but I can't prove it. That's just a speculation. Like all these commentators, they're just speculating. But as a general summary of this chapter, we see a lot of judgment on Israel, on God's people. Then we see judgment on Israel's enemies and restoration after judgment on Israel's enemies. That's a theme that we should always keep in our minds as we plow through the underbrush of the book of Isaiah as we examine the trees. We need to remember there's a forest to remember too. So ladies and gentlemen, with Isaiah chapter 29, we are now concluded and we are ready to go in our next audio to Isaiah 30, which I will entitle, Do Not Go Down to Egypt. I hope to see you in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.